COVID-19 upended the American education system, and the impacts of the pandemic on schools will likely take decades to fully understand. Without doubt, the past 15 months of school were unlike any other in history. The technology that made widespread remote learning possible just didn't exist a few years ago. Students and educators had huge obstacles to overcome to keep on track, and some say the resilience and perseverance that was shown may be the most positive legacy of this moment. But of course, there have been plenty of drawbacks. There are big questions about learning loss, attendance rates are down, failure rates are up, and many students missed out on a year of normal social development. The isolation of virtual school has also been set against a backdrop of family members getting sick, dying, or losing jobs due to COVID. All the while, there's been a spike in deadly gun violence in cities across the country. This is Schooled, live. I'm Kevin McCrory, and in this episode, we're unpacking how the COVID year of schooling has affected students, parents, and educators in the Philadelphia area, where city public schools were all or mostly virtual the entire year, and meanwhile, suburban schools and private schools had a much wider range of in-person options. Our conversation was recorded this month during a live event with a panel who spoke intimately about how this all affected their lives. Charity Robbins is a rising junior at Carver High School of Engineering and Science in North Philadelphia. Keziah Ridgway is a history teacher at Northeast High School in Northeast Philadelphia. Maritza Gurity is a North Philadelphia parent of four public school students. She's also the secretary at the neighborhood elementary school where some of her children attend. And Matthew Fisher is the principal of Conwell Egan Catholic High School in Bucks County, which is part of the Archdiocese of Philadelphia. Our conversation was edited for length and clarity. Maritza, I want to start with you from a parent point of view. Can you give us an insight into how the past 15 months looked? What was it like for your family as you navigated remote school and the challenges of the pandemic?
Well, first, thank you very much for having me. I can say honestly that I consider myself one of the fortunate ones because I am not alone in my household. You know, my husband, he and I worked in conjunction while I worked in the school. He took some time off from his job of many years to be able to stay home with our little ones and assist them with navigating the Chromebooks. So, and I know that for many families, especially in certain parts of Philadelphia, that was not an option. There were many single parents or single guardian households that had to make a choice of either working to maintain the roofs over their heads or staying home to help their little ones. Or if it was multi-siblings in the home, many siblings had to now become caretakers for their younger siblings to help them log on every day so that their guardian or parent could then go to work.
But just what was it like trying to get, you know, four kids to learn on laptops in your house all at the same time?
Well, my teenager, she didn't have any issues. My rising second grader, it was a little bit of a learning curve. And surprisingly, the two little ones, you'd be surprised at how quickly 3 and 4 year old children learned how to navigate Google Classroom.
Yeah.
So the most we had to do was just set it up and leave it on. But they very quickly learned how to click on that little phone button, click on that camera button, and hang up whenever they were bored, because they did that a lot too. They would just hang up. And then the one thing they kept on forgetting is that mommy works at the school, so mommy can reach the teachers and the teachers can reach mommy to let her know, hey, for some reason, your children aren't locked on. So it was interesting, to say the least.
Extra layer of accountability in your house, for sure.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Charity, speak to us a little bit about what it was like as a student. You know, you went remote last March, and you never had a single class this year as a high school student in person. What was that like?
I mean, it was very, I felt like I was missing out on a lot. And it was very, just sad at first. I'm like, oh man, I'm missing my sophomore year, but I understand why, and it's something that I feel like has a lot of pros and cons. While I wasn't able to go to any classes in person, I felt that because of that I was able to build more intimate relationships with my teachers, because everyone's navigating this together. So I feel like it helped me build stronger bonds with my teachers as well as like my classmates as well, because I mean, like, everyone is bored at home, and I feel like that's something, it's like a common factor that we all share as a school community. So I feel like while it's like something I'm bummed over that like I didn't get to attend any classes this year, it also has like its pros. So yeah.
And Keziah Ridgway, you're a teacher at Northeast High. So for you too, you had this whole year of students that you never got to interact with in person. What was that like?
Yeah. Well, it was hard at first, but I think I had a bit of an easier time compared to my other colleagues because I had students that had such big personalities that they were able to bring that into the Zoom session. So at first it was a little awkward. We're all getting to learn each other. You know, should I comment in the chat? Should I not? I think that's what a lot of students were up against. Some put their cameras on, some didn't, but I just wanted to set the tone. So I told them, look, you know, I know that some of you, you're very shy, you're very uncomfortable. It's a lot to sit in front of a screen every day. So if it makes you feel comfortable to turn your camera off, then do that, but you still have to participate. So either you're going to unmute or we're going to have a party in the chat. And so we eventually got there, and I have to say, like, every single class, there was never a class period where I did not have some sort of interaction in the chat. It was never a class period where I didn't have students who were able to unmute and share. Now, I know that for some of my other colleagues, it was not that simple. Yeah. It wasn't that easy. But I really feel like what made the biggest difference for me was making them feel comfortable and playing music and doing, taking that time to deep breathe and center ourselves before we jumped into the lesson. And I tried to make it fun for them. So I'm going to crack jokes. If I have to stand up and dance and like make a fool of myself, then I'm willing to do that. But I think for a lot of students, they enjoyed that because they understood that they had a teacher who understood what they were going through. And that is what made them show up every single day.
And you had to like relearn what it meant to be a teacher in a different context, right? Like that was a big learning curve for you to be a virtual teacher. What was that like?
Well, I'm a mom of four. So all of my kids were home with me. So not only am I learning how to be a virtual teacher, I'm also navigating life as a mom of a teenager in high school, one in middle school and two in elementary school. So outside of the having to mute myself to tell my kids stop making noise or you can't get lunch, but really trying to figure out a way to make learning fun. I realized that kids they want to be here and they want to learn. They just don't want to have a teacher lecturing them every single day. So you can't do that. You're not in the classroom anymore. You can't write notes on the board and expect kids to take notes. So yeah, we took notes some days, but the kids would say what they liked too. So I listened to them and they would say, Ms. Ridgway, we don't want to do Cornell notes this week. Can we do this and can we do this? Yes, you can. So I think that's really important also to allow them to have a bit of agency.
Okay. Matthew Fisher, you're the principal of Conwell Egan, like we said, a Catholic school in the Archdiocese in Bucks County. And you and your staff and your students have been basically doing hybrid learning since, what, September of 2020. So very different experience from what we've been hearing from the Philadelphia perspective, the Philadelphia Public School perspective. What was that like to figure out how to basically what you were virtual a few days a week and you were in person a few days a week?
Yes, it took a lot of adapting for our teachers, for our students, for our parents at home. I would say it took, 9 months of adapting, right? So I don't know if we ever fully got there. But, our students were appreciative for their days that they were able to be in person. The feedback that we gathered from them throughout the school year was that they much rather be in person than at home during their virtual days. We did have some families and students who opted to be fully virtual. So they were able to attend their classes through Zoom every single day. Their camera, their Zoom put them right into the classroom with the rest of the students and their teacher. So families did have that option if they didn't feel safe sending their kids back to school. But, I think in the end, it was the right decision to come back to school in September. We were fortunate to have the resources to make our building safe, to make the learning environment safe. I think we had a learning plan in place that allowed our students to continue to learn. I commend everyone else who's on this panel because just a few months that we ended the end of last school year, we were fully virtual. And after those 3 months, I guess, I think everyone was ready to get back to school. So for them to be able to get through an entire school year in that same situation, you know, hats off to them.
I would have expected maybe more pushback from faculty on going back into the classroom, but you say that really wasn't the case there.
We were fortunate. Every single one of our teachers showed up just about every single day. We didn't have any teachers who went out on leave. You know, some of them were a little more hesitant than others to come back, but they all came back, and, you know, some of them were excited and wanted the students in school every day. So I think the feelings about returning to in-person instruction were mixed, but they showed up every day. And when we came back in September, they hit the ground running and adapted to it, I think, quicker than we had, you know, expected them to.
And I'm sure the question on a lot of people's minds is, okay, so were there a lot of COVID cases?
So we went through, I would say, the first 2 months of the school year with, I think, two. And then right before Thanksgiving, about a week before Thanksgiving, I think when the entire state and country and maybe the world kind of erupted with COVID cases, so did our school. We never got to a point where we hit a percentage of our population where we needed to shut down. But if we had two through the first 2 months, in the 2 weeks before Thanksgiving, we may have had 12. So, you know, it increased. And that was pretty steady through, you know, Christmas break. And then, you know, through contact tracing and working with the Bucks County Health Department, there wasn't a single case that we had throughout that time that we believed or the county believed was either transmitted or spread through the students being in school. And I think a lot of studies out there indicated that schools were ultimately safe places and were not spreading the virus. So, you know, we had a few more throughout the school year. I mean, it never really stopped up until a couple weeks ago. We still had two more, but it never got to the point where we considered going fully virtual for an extended period of time or anything like that.
Yeah, that's, I mean, remarkable. Like you said, to go through November, December of 2020, when the cases were exploding and it seemed like everything was shutting down, you guys were there in person through all of that. That is pretty remarkable. Yeah. I'm curious, Maritza, like from your point of view as both a parent and a school employee, do you look back on this year and think, I wish the district did something different? I wish Philadelphia did something different.
I wish the district did many things different. I wish the district, first, I want to commend all of the administrators and educators for doing a tremendous job and doing the best that they could with what they were afforded. I wish the district would have had some more parent input. I wish there would have been conversations had with families to ask them, what can we do to make things better? What do you need?
Trying to think back to last summer and what the district was doing, what the school board was doing. And in those early months of the pandemic, the pushback from at least the people who showed up to the school board meetings was pretty strong in saying, we do not want people in the building. And then there was a survey that was done in, I'm going to say, late October, early November, where they tried to collect some input and then the cases spiked.
Yes.
But I guess just outside of just the idea of you would want them to have more input from parents to make decisions, did you personally wish something was different? Did you wish there was in-person option? Did you wish something fundamentally was different?
I wish, my thought, like every single time there was an issue going on with the constant pushback, the three-time pushback of the date of when hybrid would start, I got the phone calls at my school. So I was the first person the parent would speak to express their concern, their frustration, their anger, their agreement or disagreement. So I felt I was in Switzerland because I was a parent. I felt the same way about certain things. Then I also had to think about it as an employee of the district and say, okay, well, we want to keep everyone safe. We want to make sure that everyone is safe. We tried our best to communicate to all the families, and I'm quite sure all the other district schools did, in letting families know what safety measures were being afforded at each particular school. You know, families' input is required, and then there's that big piece. And out of all these surveys, these polls that were done by the National Parents Union across the country, 82% of parents said that providing quality technology was a big pressure cooker in their household. Not every family could afford to pay a high cable internet bill.
Right.
So we have cases of children that did not attend at all this entire school year as a result of not having access to internet. Even if they were given a hotspot, they couldn't get to where the hotspots were being given out, or they were told you were not eligible to get, you know, Comcast Essentials, which mm-hmm. that service was very sparse, and I'm going to keep my language, you know, G-rated, but it was terrible coverage, terrible access. One hotspot per household is not going to cover a multi-children household. So there were a lot of things that were happening that hopefully with all this money coming in from the federal government, the district is going to be receiving millions, do the right thing, get the right resources and information, but make sure that parent voice is heard and involved in that conversation.
Charity, we're talking about parent voice. I'm wondering what you think about student voice, and if that was something that should have also been more considered, and how that could have been better integrated into the district's plans or the general plans in this region for school reopening.
Yeah, I also agree that there should have been more voices from the people who are like directly affected by the changes that's made, like from above. Like, I can't tell you how many times my schedule changed this year, and it's just all so confusing, you know? Like, in the beginning, I think I was getting out of school at like 2:40, and then I started getting out at 1, and then all of a sudden started getting out at 2. And it's just really hard to manage, especially when you're so used to a schedule. So some of the stuff that you commit to, it like goes with that schedule. Like, okay, well, I do robotics at this time because around this time is when I'm doing homework. You have to like schedule time for homework and everything. And that, like, there were so many times where that, like, I had to just change everything. You would think that since everyone is going through this problem and since students are directly affected because our education is in jeopardy by all of these changes, that we would, like, our voices would be heard, but it wasn't. So I am hoping that next year when hopefully we are in person, that we do have more input on the things that are decided that concern our futures, you know?
Charity, I'm curious. Okay, so say if Dr. Haidt came to you in October and said, should we have in-person school for high school kids at least a couple days a week? And whatever you tell me, that's what we're going to do. And how would you balance your desire to be around your classmates and kind of have that typical high school experience with the COVID concerns and the health concerns that, of course, you know, were real and were in people's minds? What would you have said?
Well, firstly, I would be very intimidated because I think it's important when you make a big decision to have input from other people because you only see life through your lens. And I know that, like, for a lot of my friends, like, they suffer from, like, autoimmune diseases. So they physically cannot go back. So if I were to say, oh, yeah, I want to go back just from my own personal desires, that wouldn't have been fair to anyone else. So if I was like tasked with deciding our fate, I would want input. Like, that would be like my main thing, but not just from like the people at my school, but like around the district. Because I mean, it's so important, but I think in October, I would have said no, just because the COVID concerns. But if we were asked like around, let's say like a lot of my friends saying, oh, I wish we could have went back like after spring break, like also wish that was an option.
Yeah.
Like, if it was later, I would have said, yeah, definitely, because, like, we have access to vaccinations. We, like, know more about how to keep this, like, controlled, and we know how to keep ourselves safe. In October, I would have said no, honestly. But if I was asked later, I would have liked the option to be in person at least for a little bit before, like, the year ended.
Keziah, your thoughts on that. Did you have an advocacy point of view through the year on should we be back or not?
So I was one of the teachers leading the charge to not go back. And the reason why I didn't feel like it was a good idea to go back is because I am from Philadelphia, born and raised on the playground. No, I'm from Philadelphia, and I teach at the largest high school in Philadelphia. Honestly, Northeast High is larger than some towns in America. We have about 3,500 students and over 200 staff members and teachers. You asked Marissa a question about, you know, what does she wish the district had done different? What does she wish the district did different? And I'm going to answer that by saying I wish that the district had actually started to really care about building conditions and buildings 20 years ago. I would have asked that the district started removing asbestos and lead and all the other health hazards that we have within our building 20, 25, 30 years ago. Honestly, this has been a problem since the 1970s, 1980s, about having asbestos in buildings. So not only were we involved in a health pandemic, but we were also involved in a education system which has forgotten our children. They did. They just forgot them. And I think it's very interesting how certain parents now are concerned with learning loss. Where were you 10 years ago? Where were you 5 years ago? Where were you when I graduated in 2003, where 2 years or 3 years before I graduated, the state took over and there was no change? You know, I think that teachers did the best that they could, and students did the best that they could, and administrators did the best that they could. But honestly, society did not do the best that it could for our kids. And they haven't done that for years. I just think that the things that could have been done in order to ensure we were able to get back earlier were things that needed to be done 20 years before, right? Like making sure our ventilation was up to date. You know what I'm saying? Yeah, making sure that there's air conditioning and heating in our rooms. And so I think that was the difference.
That's Keziah Ridgway, history teacher in Philadelphia. We've also been talking with Philly High School rising junior Charity Robbins and public school parent Maritza Gurdy, plus Matthew Fisher, the principal of a Catholic high school in the Philly suburbs. After a short break, we'll be back with more on how the COVID-19 year affected students' mental health.
You know, I find myself like feeling like I want to be alone, and I know that's not really who I am because that's not who I was like a year ago. I can't even recognize myself now.
Welcome back to Schooled. In this special edition based on a live virtual event, we're sorting through the COVID-19 year of school with people who have lived it intimately. We're joined by Keziah Ridgway, history teacher in Philadelphia, Philly High School rising junior Charity Robbins, public school parent Maritza Gurdy, Matthew Fisher, the principal of a Catholic high school in the Philly suburbs, and joining us for this next segment is WHYY education reporter Avi Wolfman-Aaron. Before the break, we were talking about how building conditions and mistrust of infrastructure in the Philadelphia school system contributed to keeping many schools virtual all year long. I then asked Principal Matthew Fisher how he viewed that decision from his Catholic school in Bucks County, where students were in classrooms since September.
The Archdiocese did a great job in the summer once, you know, it was determined that we would be coming back on their hybrid schedule to get our ventilation system checked and upgraded so that it was, you know, ready to go come September. You know, we added air conditioning into all of our classrooms, which helped increase ventilation, you know, hopefully to make things a little bit safer. So, and we had a health and safety reopening plan that we felt and the Archdiocese felt would keep our students safe while they were in our building. You know, before I came back to Comelegan in 2016, I spent 8 years in the School District of Philadelphia. I was at Edison High School, which, you know, I had a great experience for 8 years. But, you know, hearing what everyone else on the panel is saying, I understand. I'll leave it at that. So, you know, I understand the situation that they were in. I understand the struggle they went through throughout the school year on, you know, when are they going to come back to school? The teachers thinking it's not safe to come back. I totally get it. I lived it for 8 years. And yeah, I think that at our school, at least at Comelegan, we were probably in a better spot to open our school safely in September. We felt comfortable bringing our faculty and staff back. We felt comfortable bringing our students back. I think the fact that we were able to have, you know, half of the students in the classes. So instead of having 30 students in a class, you have 15 students and they can socially distance, and they were required to wear masks throughout the school year.
Avi Wolf-Bedarin, I want to bring you into the conversation. I mean, you were following all this stuff pretty closely throughout the year, both from the public school side and the private school side. When you think back on this year, like, what will you remember most about how things unfolded?
Gosh, what will I remember most? I mean, it's hard to pick just one thing. I mean, I'll probably most remember conversations with teachers, parents and students about what they were going through, just the types of conversations we're having now. There was just so many remarkable stories and so many lives that had been upturned. I mean, and not always in negative ways, but, you know, people, the adaptability of people is really, really remarkable. I think if I were to the one thing I might take away from sort of a larger level from this year is that there's lots of advantages to being big and having scale, but in a time like this, it did feel often like the larger entities, whether they were districts or not, it was just harder for them to move and adapt as the knowledge of the disease and the way that it interacted with schools was constantly changing. And it just felt like whether it was a parochial school or charter school, it was easier to like build consensus in these like smaller groups of people than it was in larger districts. And I don't know if that's really anybody's fault. It's just, I think something, it's just sort of the way of the world. When you have a smaller group of people, I just feel like it's easier to reassure people and get people's buy-in and build trust. And that's not to exonerate the school district of Philadelphia or some other large districts, because they did plenty of things to erode trust over many, many years. And Keziah Ridgeway spoke to that. But, you know, I kind of saw it play out in smaller communities, smaller school districts in just a different way. And I do think that's something that I'll probably think about moving forward.
Yeah. The other thing we haven't really gotten into yet too much is just how much the underlying backdrop of the economic ramifications of the pandemic were behind so many of these that were happening at the same time. I think back to a story that you did, Avi, about a mom in Chester County who was essentially homeless through much of the pandemic and was still trying to navigate school for her children. And like that just was happening all across our region. In many times it was invisible to folks who weren't intimately involved in it. And that story you did, I guess, spotlighted that. Anything you want to add about that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, we'll be sifting through the ramifications of this last year and a half for the next 20 years. I mean, there's a lot of students. One of the difficult things, right, is you know, when you're in person, that there are certain things you can pick up on that are very difficult to pick up on, I imagine, or I've been told, in the virtual environment. And there are a lot of students that I think we could safely say have sort of just been on the periphery, on the fringe for a year and a half now, and have been hard to reach, whether it's because of technological problems, whether it's because of sort of lives that have been uprooted in some way. And when students return to something more approximating normal, there will be a lot of bridge building to be done between schools and students and parents. And it's going to be a massive project, unlike anything that I imagine any of us have ever seen.
Yeah, Maritza, I'm wondering if you can speak to the stuff that we're talking about now and now kind of thinking forward, where people are going to be coming back in the fall. There are these federal stimulus dollars to try to help in many different ways. What do you think that the district or individual schools need to do to kind of reconnect with some of those people that Avi is mentioning that like maybe were on the periphery or they just stopped attending school or they're just, they're a big question mark at this point. How should we be re-engaging them? What needs to happen?
The schools need to be the community hubs again. They need to be the place where a family can go or they can call and speak to the school leader or the teacher and say, you know, I'm finally able to get back. We've been having issues. I mean, we had so many instances of families calling in throughout the school year with very different reasons, a family becoming homeless, a family having to leave their home due to a domestic violence situation, a family being the victim of a fire, a family being the victim of multi people in the home, unfortunately dying due to cases of COVID, a family losing family members, a mother, grandmother, father, due to the gun violence in the city. I mean, it was a myriad of things all throughout this school year that I saw that I had to, you know, we got the first call. The school family immediately went into action and provided whatever they could for the families that were in need, whether it was, you know, material things, money being collected. But all these reasons, you know, when families come back in September, there's still going to be the issues of families having difficulties because of what happened this year in finding before and after care, affordable before and after care. So if all this money that's coming in to the school districts, if monies are allotted to those schools in those areas, in those catchment areas, in those zip codes that the school leaders know their school population's needs, and they say, let's connect with this program outside of the school that will provide before and after care. Or better yet, why don't we offer more money to our existing employees in the schools to see if they could come in earlier and help watch these children at 7:30 in the morning until the school day starts, or pay them so they can stay until 5 or 5:30 to help with those working families. I mean, the thing is, if we want to be able to keep our children in the school, be of as much support as possible to the families that are in need, provide those programs. There are a lot of what I don't want to see is wasteful spending.
Yeah.
As a parent, I don't want to see money coming down the pike for nonsensical things. Just do not wastefully spend the money. And once again, I'm going to keep on hammering this. Get the input of the parents as well as the teachers. Teachers know their children. Teachers know their students. They understand them. They know when they're not having a good day. They do that. Respect the voice of the educators and the parents and guardians. Don't leave it just up to admin or the people at 440. And I'm saying this as an employee. Yeah. Don't just leave it up to the people that are making six-figure salaries. Talk to us. And speaking about salaries, raise employee salaries. Yeah. Raise it. Yeah. You don't know how many teachers are not coming back because it was too much of a stress and the pay was not worth it. Mm-hmm. There should be not one teacher across the country that has to work a side hustle, a side job to make ends meet. A secretary won poverty wages. You got to do better. You're going to get all this money. Pay people what they're worth. I'm sorry.
No, I liked it.
Charity, I just wanted, if you could reflect on from what you've seen of your peers, your friends, as far as mental health issues and how this year of isolation has affected that.
It's been really hard being virtual, and I've seen that in a lot of my friends. And my school actually suffered a loss due to that. So it's just been like really hard with everything being virtual and just changing, because at first, like, you're like, oh wow, we're gonna be away from school. Like, this sounds amazing. But it gets to the point where it's like you're home 24/7, you feel like you're locked, like, in a cage almost. This used to be the place that you like love. You love coming home at the end of the day. and just like winding down and knowing you're here 24/7 and you want to get out. It's been mental health. I've seen among my peers, it's been like a real struggle, even with myself. I find that just like the certain characteristics that I had in my freshman year when I was in person, I just don't have anymore. Like, I used to be really social. It was just very easy to like be in a crowd. And now I find myself like feeling like I want to be alone. And I know that's not really who I am, because that's not who I was like a year ago. I can't even recognize myself now. It's like when I'm in a group of people, I feel like, oh man, maybe this would be easier if I was isolated, because I wouldn't have to talk to anyone. I wouldn't have to like face my anxiety. And like a lot of my friends, they like just struggle with mental health. And the only good thing that I can say is that I know like now, if I need to ever reach out to a teacher, I like, they're going to be there for me. And even like my counselors at school, like they are really there for you. And that's something that it took going through this to really truly appreciate, because there have been so many times like things just weren't okay at home. And like I would reach out to like a teacher or even like a counselor, and they would be like, okay, you want to talk? And it's something I really appreciate. And so I think it's sad that we have to go through this for a lot of stuff to come to light, like to feel like, oh my goodness, this is not what I want. Like, I don't want to be isolated, because you like being with your school, and now like I can't wait to get back in the building. So I think that also mental health, the topic of it, is something that needs to be talked about more in schools. Like, I've been trying to work with my teacher to see if we can do something where like it's implemented throughout the day, where there are like places we can go like in the middle of class if this is just like not our day, because you have off days where it's just like nothing is working and you need that time to speak to someone. So I really hope like this topic of mental health is something that's no longer like taboo to people, and it's just we can raise more awareness about it.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being so honest and open, Charity. Really incredible, and we appreciate your perspective a lot. And clearly you're an incredible student. You have a periodic table and a solar system behind you. So just on that point though, like, okay, we're talking about these federal funds coming in. What do you think is like the number one priority for spending that money, to speaking to the point that you're just speaking to? Like, people are going to be back in September. Where's the need? Where do we put our energy and our money?
Honestly, the classrooms, we need more resources. Like, there isn't enough. At my last school, I didn't have access to like anything. We didn't have good internet in the building. The Chromebooks were so bad. Like, we had assigned Chromebooks and like they just didn't work. It was really like weird. It's something that needs to be fixed, because a lot of the stuff, while we do stuff on paper while we're in person, there's sometimes when we need the internet to like do research. And the fact that we're in school and we don't have access to this stuff, because like there isn't enough money being poured into the schools for the stuff we actually need. We need new textbooks. The textbooks are like, they aren't in good condition because they've been used for so many years, and you would just think to replace them, but that hasn't happened. I think that's some of the stuff we really need. So like internet, we need textbooks. And even I think this is something so important that schools should offer like more pencils and like notebooks for students that can't, like they don't have the means to get the stuff for themselves. Like, for example, there are some schools that you need to like get your own calculator, but you need like the good calculator, like the one that's like $150. Mm-hmm. And some parents, they just do not have the money and the resources to do that. And as a result of that, like students struggle. So I think the district just needs to really pay more attention to the students, you know, and give them more resources.
Yeah. Keziah Ridgway, just bring you into the conversation on this point of federal stimulus funding. There's a lot of it out there.
Yes.
And, you know, the district has some decisions to make. Like, how do we spend this in the most optimal way? What do you think?
Yeah. Well, I think before COVID happened, it was estimated that we would need about $1 to $2 billion to get every single school up to par. And that's whether we need to like tear down a school to rebuild it or redo it. There are some schools that you can't even put updated air conditioning in because the electrical is so bad. So it would just probably short and go away, you know, and go out. And so in terms of what we should do with the money, I think we should spend the money on updating buildings, mental health, because yes, this is it's a real issue. And I think suicide completion has risen about 60% over the last 10 years among children ages 10 up to young adults ages 24. So 10 to 24. And so we need more counselors in our schools. Sometimes there's like 500 students for one counselor. That's unacceptable. The number by pediatricians, American Society of Pediatricians, I believe, says 250 per counselor, right? And so we need mental health crisis centers in our schools. I do think that we have 33 kids in class right now. I don't know who decided that that's the best way to educate children, but I am so sorry to inform them that it is not the best way to educate children. There should be no more than 20, and I really think 15, but no more than 20 children in every single classroom. And guess what? There needs to be a co-teacher in every single classroom, because it is impossible to be able to teach 33 children and even 20 children, when you have children that have so many different needs. You have children coming in on a fifth grade reading level in ninth grade, a third grade reading level in ninth grade. We have children that are unable to write going into high school. This is unacceptable. And this isn't something that just started. We're not talking about a learning loss because of COVID. We're talking about a learning pandemic as a result of not fairly funding Philadelphia schools. We are the largest school district, or one of the largest school districts in the state of Pennsylvania, and we do not get the money that we deserve. And many of these children are being left behind. And so when we talk about the gun violence situation that we have in our city, what we're talking about is the consistent and deliberate underfunding of Philadelphia schools, which means that it puts kids at a higher risk of becoming dropouts. And kids who become dropouts turn to a life of crime. And that is just facts. That is the reality.
Just because you brought up the gun violence crisis, I'm wondering if you can speak to how this year has gone with students that you had in class, and how you navigated that difficult situation virtually.
I mean, not only are we dealing with gun violence, but also we were smack dab in the middle of a uprising that occurred after the murders of George Floyd and Ahmaud Arbery and Breonna Taylor. So you had students that would, I'm going to be honest with you, Kevin, and say that there were moments when I didn't teach. There were moments when we all sat on Zoom and cried together. I had a student that knew Walter Wallace Jr., who was shot and killed in West Philadelphia in the middle of a mental health crisis. And they found out from us. Their family didn't tell them because they wanted to wait until after school. And they found out in my classroom.
Wow.
And so what we're talking about is trauma. We're talking about a population here in Philadelphia that are absolutely traumatized. We have a mental health crisis here in Philadelphia, and that is what is leading to a large number of the murders and the violence that we're seeing in the city. Because there's, and I say this as a mother who had to deal with a child who had a mental health crisis during COVID. I'm a teacher, and I have good insurance, and my husband works for Drexel, and he has good insurance. And guess what? There was a moment that we had to plead to our insurance company to pay for our child to stay in the hospital that they were staying in so that they could get the treatment that they needed. And if that happened to me as a middle-class person with two excellent insurances, what is happening to parents who do not have those resources? So yes, I am that teacher where I listen to my students. And if my students need to cry, if my students need to talk, then we are going to stop. We are not going to talk about African-American history. We're going to talk about feelings. We're going to talk about emotions. And we're going to talk about how can I, as a teacher, empower you to use your voice? Because we as adults are always talking about what needs to change, but we keep failing our kids. So maybe it's time to allow our students to have a voice, listen to them, and actually implement what they're asking us to implement. And maybe that is when things will change, and we'll see violence drop, and we'll see gun violence drop, and we'll see more students invested in their city and in their schools and in their futures.
Matthew Fisher, you know, we're talking about some of the underlying issues in Philadelphia and how maybe the school district can address them when things go back to 5 days a week in school, which is the tentative plan in Philadelphia in the fall. Mental health, though, clearly is not an issue that stops at the city of Philadelphia's border. And you're dealing with that in Bucks County as well. And I'm curious what you think about how you're preparing for the fall and what that's going to mean for your school.
We were fortunate even prior to the pandemic, you know, just from observing our students and gathering their feedback and listening to them, we thought it was important to invest in school counseling. So we were, you know, and as a private school, we rely on raising money and our alumni to, you know, donate money just to keep the doors open. And we were fortunate to have one of our alumni invest in school counseling because, you know, it was something we believe so strongly. And so through that, you know, our student counselor ratio this year was 115-1.
Wow.
So we feel like, and you know what, you can never be on top of everything, right? So in a school like Northeast High School, 3,500 kids, I mean, that's almost an impossible task for those teachers and for those counselors. In our school with 460 students this year and, you know, four full-time counselors, it's still, I mean, we're lucky, but it's still almost an impossible task. We don't know what to expect in the fall. And we're preparing for that. So that's an ongoing conversation that, you know, the Archdiocese is having at that level with the principals and the school leaders in trying to prepare for what the fall is going to look like. You're going to be back in school 5 days a week. Is there going to be a transitional period for the students, even though they may have been in school 2 or 3 days a week, now they're in school 5 days a week, or the students that were virtual for the entire year coming back to school 5 days a week, or what the students may have experienced being at home, you know, for 2 to 3 to 5 days a week. I think it's something that we're going to have to keep an eye on in Bucks County, in the city of Philadelphia, out in Chester County, everywhere. It's, as you said in your question, mental health doesn't stop anywhere. I think we're in a fortunate position with the investments that we've made in school counseling, but it's still something that we're going to have to keep an eye on heading into the next school year for sure.
Yeah. I do want to acknowledge that Charity Robbins had to leave. Unfortunately, she had another school event that she told us about ahead of time. Would have wished to get her thoughts on one more time in this conversation, but there'll have to be another event. Charity could be the star of it, as we've learned today. Avi, wanted to bring you into the conversation. Again, when we're talking about how school districts essentially across the state and the region are going to use these stimulus funds, what do you see kind of momentum building behind? What are you going to be most watching kind of on this issue come fall?
Well, certainly a lot of the money's not spoken for at this point, but the first thing that a lot of school districts and charter schools have done is invest in some sort of either tutoring or summer recovery programs. In part, I think, just because it's the most immediate, obvious thing to do right now. I think there are a couple of areas to watch. One is how much of the money is invested in things that we would frame as like academic recovery. So typically that's math and reading, sometimes science and social studies, but sort of trying to fill in academic skills gaps that might have developed over the last 18 months. How much of it will be invested in a lot of the stuff we're talking about here, which is, you know, mental health, social readjustment. And the always tricky thing with that is it's often difficult to measure how well those things are working. And typically, administrators will gravitate towards things that you can sort of measure and prove, right, that there is some sort of effect. And it's the old saw that you treasure what you measure. And obviously test scores are the most obvious form of measurement. Test scores are typically focused around math and reading. So, you know, there will certainly be pressure to do skills recovery in those areas. And I guess the question is how much of the money is invested in that versus things that, you know, we all acknowledge are important but are difficult to sort of definitively measure. And then I think the third category of thing is something that Keziah brought up, which is how much of it should be invested in things that are really not directly – that it sort of existed well before the pandemic, like capital expenses, infrastructure woes, like fixing these things that built up over many, many years. The federal government could have said, look, we want you to spend all this money on, you know, academic or social needs directly related to the pandemic, but they didn't. They said you could spend a good amount of it if you want on improving your buildings, your pipes, your HVAC, all that stuff, building new schools. So that's an option. And it'll be interesting to see how many school districts sort of decide that that's how they want to spend the money. And it'll be an evolving conversation over the next couple of years.
We're coming up on the end of our event, but I'm just curious for, I guess, one more question. Maritza, you know, this Zoom era that we've all gone through, we see into each other's lives in just a different way, right? Like the role between boss and employee changed, the role between teacher and student changed. Things became more intimate. I'm just curious if you can pinpoint something from this past year that made you see the system differently or made you appreciate something different about how the education system works and how that kind of resonated in your kids' life too.
Well, having a view into someone's personal space, I hope that for those educators and administrative folks that had those hard conversations about whatever frustrations they felt about having to teach to a blank screen. The only thing that ever crossed my mind because of my background is that you do not know each family's home situation. So it may not have been that the child was being disrespectful by not showing their screen, but they may have not been in a space. They may have not been afforded a corner or a wall or a room where it was quiet enough or that it was clean or that, you know, there was even light. So I'm hoping that they continued throughout this experience, just offer everyone grace with that regard. Even for teachers, you know, we don't know every single teacher's home situation. So they may have been times where they did not want to be seen online also. But it was just part of their role. They had to be seen, so they did the best that they could. I had to actually jump in on a class because they couldn't find a substitute. So I had to sit in on a second grade class and keep some second graders busy for about 3 or 4 hours. And I was like, my goodness, remember all the obstacles and then now view them as opportunities to be able to affect change and to make things better for everyone, the students and the teachers and everyone, all the adults in the building for this coming school year.
Because I'm guessing you grew in empathy for your students through this year?
I mean, I've always been the empathetic, but, you know, like I've always had empathy for my students. And so that's why, you know, I probably was one of the rebels where I wasn't really forcing kids to like put their cameras on, you know.
That wasn't frustrating to you some days to just see that blank screen?
It was so frustrating. It did take a toll on my mental health on more than one occasion because I'm like, are they getting it? Do they hear me? Do they understand? But every second I would have those thoughts, somebody would comment in the chat or somebody would unmute and I'm like, okay, they get it. They hear me. They understand. And so, it was hard, but I also had to have grace.
I think I'm going to have to let that be the final word for this conversation. I think it's a good spot to end. So thank you so much to all of our panelists today. Keziah Ridgway, Maritza Gurity, Matthew Fisher, and earlier we had Charity Robbins. You guys were great panelists. I really enjoyed this conversation. Thank you so much. Schooled is produced by WHYY in Philadelphia. For this special live episode, Joy Soto was our event producer, and we had special help from our intern, Luisa Suarez. Special thanks to our guests and to reporters Avi Wolfman-Arendt and Miles Bryan. WHYY's Vice President of News is Sandra Clark. I'm your host, Kevin McCrory. For more on this episode, including a video of our live event, visit whyy.org/